Have the marshal call court to session, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Sleater, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 14, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar today. This is our first case. It's A221314, State of Minnesota versus Maleka. Counsel, you've all practiced before us before. Welcome back. I'm going to ask that you mute your microphone today if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. You each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. Let us know if there's a specific way you'd like us to reference you. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, members of the panel, counsel. My name is Sean McCarthy. I'm an assistant Rice County attorney. I appear today in this criminal matter on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'm going to be frank. This is an interesting case. I've never seen anything like this in 25 years of doing criminal work. I want to warn you all of that ahead of time. I'm going to ask you to stretch some boundaries. In particular, the trial court erred in suppressing the evidence on these specific facts. That's the key piece here. I will acknowledge right up front, Lindquist is my toughest legal argument. You've read the briefs. There's a few lines from Lindquist that seem to say basically, you know, hey, we haven't adopted anything else, so nothing else counts. The problem is that is wholly inadequate and indeed inconsistent with our Supreme Court, our Minnesota Supreme Court's own other decisions, which require the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court to not just borrow a couple of lines and stop your analysis and skip over inconvenient facts. What Golden Valley versus Wiebesick, State versus Carter from 1999, and Kahn versus Griffin, our Minnesota Supreme Court from 2005, all three of those cases say if we have identical provisions from the U.S. Constitution and the Minnesota Constitution, we don't just skip over them and not do an analysis of the law.
Mr. McCarthy, I'm going to stop you before you get too far afield because, you know, we're on a, this is a review of a suppression motion. We're on de novo review here. And I question whether the warrant was actually recalled and whether the exclusionary rule applies at all. And so let me ask you a few questions about what the record shows happened in this case. It appears to me from my review of the record that there was a backdated change in the register of actions. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Two different backdates, and they were inserted out of sequence from the actual events.
And do we have any information about who did that?
We know that the court did it because the only information
What does that mean? Does that mean? The court.
Your Honor, we don't know who within the court. We have a notice of judicial determination, which is not an order of record and not a transcript. There are no facts developed here because we had two different judges in two different proceedings part of the confusion.
So let me ask this. Okay, so the issuance of a warrant is a judicial process, correct?
Yes.
Only a judge can issue a warrant?
Yes.
Would you agree that only a judge can recall a warrant?
Yes.
And I don't see any order in the record that a judge issued recalling this warrant.
That is exactly correct. And in fact, Your Honor, you'll let me skip ahead about two-thirds of my argument because this is the key point here. We have no judicial record whatsoever, and the parties would be left to try to develop that record. We'd have to subpoena two judges, the court administrator, some court clerks, maybe a law clerk, to try to figure out what happened. The problem is nobody knows, and we don't have an order of record explaining whether the order was recalled or not. In fact, it doesn't appear to have ever been legally and lawfully recalled.
So if it wasn't recalled, and then law enforcement arrested Ms. Maleka pursuant to what they believed was an active warrant, then what's the basis for suppressing the evidence that was retrieved from that search incident to arrest?
The court has nailed it right on the head. There is no basis to suppress if the warrant was active and valid at the time.
Mr. McCarthy, can I clarify a couple of points? It looks to me like from your brief, from Mr. Welch's brief and the district court's order, no one contests that the judge orally ordered the warrant quashed in December of the previous year, I believe the 14th or 15th. I can't remember the date. Is that an accurate statement?
No, Your Honor. Well, we have no record evidence of that. We have
so what was the basis? Let me clarify. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me clarify, though. When I look at your brief and even your statement of the facts in the case, you seem to suggest that concede that the judge made a finding that it occurred. The court administrator confirmed that that's what the judge ordered. So what I'm trying to understand is, well, where did the judge get that then if the judge found specifically that the court did it? And would you agree that a court can orally, without need of a written order, quash a warrant? And then thereafter, the court administrator implements it by notifying dispatch, who then gets it in the system. In other words, the warrant is just as quashed as if it was in a written order.
And Your Honor has given me about four questions there, so I'm going to try to narrow it in. You're on track. This is exactly the discussion we all need to have in this case. We have two judges. Judge number one in the earlier case issues a warrant. That is of record. We have there's a record of the warrant going out in the first place. We do not have a signed judicial order with a judge's signature. We do not have an order orally on the record. We have something, as Judge Frisch just pointed out, something happened behind court administration's closed doors, but nobody knows quite what happened. And judge number two, the judge in the case with the suppression issue, had to muddle through and try to figure out what happened regarding case number one and the status of the warrant. That's the heart of the problem here.
But just to clarify, it didn't look like the judge had much trouble muddling. The judge just affirmatively said that the judge quashed it. I mean, as I read the order, it was a fairly simple issue in that sense, and that's why the judge then got to the argument that you briefed today of good faith exception.
Your Honor, I would disagree. The judge took almost the full 90-day period to issue this written order. If it was that simple, it wouldn't have taken that long. This was a judge who sat and thought and pondered and tried to read and understand the record, was trying to adopt and give credit to what the court administrator was saying in the notice of judicial determination. But the problem with that is we still don't really know what happened. And in fact, the judge in the case before this court, the judge with the suppression issue, in the exact same order where he says it was quashed or recalled, the exact same order, then the next page he says, but law enforcement saw a valid order. The court recognized, that judge in the issue, recognized the inconsistency on this record. Does that answer the court's question, I hope?
I wouldn't assume that because it took 90 days that somebody thought about it for 90 days. Second, is there any question that the warrant was quashed in some way, that for some reason a judge determined that the warrant should not have been issued?
The key here, Your Honor, to answer your question is, one of the legal flaws here is, what is a court order? And the way I thought of this, you saw in my brief, judicial intent, a mental intent to do something, is not an order of record. Intends or wants to do something, tells their clerk to do it, but if it doesn't get into the court file, doesn't become official, it's not an order of record.
Well, I know from past experience that often a judge will issue an oral determination and tell the court administrator to quash the warrant. And apparently in some way this was done, maybe at least that's the determination of the district court in this case.
And Your Honor, if I may?
You may.
The key here is we don't know if that's what happened. Did the judge think it, but forgot to tell the court administrator? did the judge tell the court administrator, but the court administrator didn't tell their staff.
But Mr.
Did
McCarthy,
the staff hear it but not enter it? We don't know.
We have the statement of the court administrator, so we know. And the judge made that finding. The court administrator said the judge ordered it quashed. So how do you resolve that when you say we don't know? And she's made that statement as a court administrator. Well, what happened? And the judge accepted that and made the finding. What basis would we have to say that's clearly erroneous?
The lack of facts and the fact that they went and backdated entries into the record out of sequence to try to, you know, explain this, that's the problem. The parties are left with literally that we'd have to have a hearing on what happened behind court administration's closed doors. There's simply no record, no findings, no judge signed off on this, except the second judge who's just trying to give credit to what a court administrator said, not what the other judge said. We don't even have a statement from the judge. We're left kind of in limbo.
Mr. McCarthy, now we've just spent the last 10 minutes discussing some monkey business that was going on in this court record. And I want to turn to your argument today, or the argument that was in your brief, which is advocating for a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, consistent with Arizona versus Evans. And I want to point your attention to Justice Ginsburg's dissent, where she is pretty clear about how we should not make assumptions that clerical errors or administrative errors in a court record with respect to quashing a warrant are conducted in good faith. And when we have a record like this with unexplained backdating going on in a court record, which appears to me to be inconsistent with judicial branch policies and procedures, and a court administrator issuing a notice of judicial determination, which I'm not quite sure that they're have any authority to do, why is it that we should adopt the principles in Arizona versus Evans when we can't be sure that this was actually conducted in good faith on this record?
A couple of answers to that, Your Honor. Part one is, one option the court could do here is, as the court suggested earlier, find that this warrant was valid and we don't have anything of record showing that the warrant was properly recalled on the record, and therefore suppression is inappropriate. That's one option. The more direct answer to the court's specific question is, we don't have anything from our Minnesota Supreme Court that's ever addressed this set of facts with this kind of a record and this kind of issue about whether it was good faith or not. In light of that, the Lindquist and the other cases that are cited in respondent's brief are wholly inadequate to address this. And this court has a duty to acknowledge U.S. Supreme Court precedent and Minnesota Supreme Court precedent to try to come up with some guidance that parties can rely on.
Well, I mean, Lindquist is pretty clear that we're only considering in Minnesota whether a good faith exception applies if it comports with the deterrent purpose of the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. And I'm not sure that the deterrent purpose would apply when we have potentially negligent or reckless behavior in, you know, with respect to the maintenance of a court record.
I agree completely. And more importantly, not only is it unclear as to what level of behavior was going on behind the closed doors for court administration, you know, I really like my court administrator. The gal who signed off on the judicial determination notice, I think she's trying to do the right thing, but she's struggling with the same thing we all are: limited budgets, limited training, this switch to, you know, online stuff and these kinds of arguments like we're doing here. And there's a lot of chaos that comes out of that. The problem with this chaos in this particular case is it leaves this court with no meaningful record to really know what happened. Accordingly, one way the court could apply the law here is to find that on these facts, when we have this backdating and very muddy record, law enforcement had zero control over that, can do nothing to fix that in the future, has no ability to set the court budget or give the court better training. And accordingly, to apply the suppression rule here would not have any value as a deterrent to correct law enforcement conduct in the future. Does that help answer the court's question?
Mr. McCarthy, one of the issues is whether there is some deterrent value in having no errors occur. And your argument that limited resources cause problems that could result in an invalid warrant being executed seem to imply that there might be some deterrent value in suppressing this.
No deterrence on the police. Law enforcement has zero power over this, and the exclusionary rule is deterring police misconduct, not court misconduct. That's the key.
How do you square that with what Justice Ginsburg said in her dissent in Arizona versus Evans?
She was seeming to say, hey, I hope that this will cause law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, courts to all sit down together and figure it out. Problem is, I think that's a little rosy, you know, to say the least.
But should the defendant suffer from the errors of the court?
Same thing would go if it was the other way. What if the order had, or the warrant was issued wrongly? It never should have been issued. The defense would be here screaming. And if there were backdating on that, this court would reverse it immediately. Same concept applies. It's the court's error, not law enforcement's error. That's what we need to focus on.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. McCarthy. Anything else from the panel before we proceed to Mr. Welch?
No.
All right. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Welch, we'll reset the clock for you, and then you may proceed. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Melvin Welch on behalf of respondent Ms. Malecha. I'm not going to get into too many of my pre-prepared notes here, but rather going to address some of the items put forth by the appellant. It seems to me that there is a lot of items here that were posited by appellant as a basis for the error here, where none of it was explored at the contested omnibus hearing. And I would remind the court that it is appellant that has the burden of proof and production in this to show that that the court did err. In fact, that has not been done here. The appellant has not taken the opportunity to ask the court for time to explore and determine why this error had occurred. It's not the respondent's obligation to do that. It's appellant's obligation to do that. Appellant hasn't taken the time to subpoena these individuals. Appellant knows which individuals it thinks it needs to ask questions of in order to root out where the errors occurred, but it hasn't done that and asked the court to do that. And ultimately,
doesn't that beg the question, though? Isn't the real question here is whether there is some deterrent value in suppressing this evidence where there was no police misconduct?
Well, I don't go to the deterrent value, Your Honor. I mean, ultimately, this court is a court of error correction. It's not here to make new policy, and there is no basis in current Minnesota precedent to support appellant's position, which is this court should rely upon federal policy and should rely upon take the role of Minnesota Supreme Court to establish new case law. That's not what this court does, and ultimately that's what appellant is asking this court to do. What we have here is a situation where the judge made a judicial finding of fact. Appellant has offered no evidence but a lot of speculation on argument as to the clearly erroneous nature of that factual finding by Judge Johnson in Rice County District Court. Apparently, an appellant posits that he took 90 days to think about it. And Judge Smith, I have to agree with your assertion earlier that it's unlikely he took the whole 90 days to think about this issue. But to make the assumption that Judge Johnson did not look into the issue, did not seek to find out what underlay his assertion that this is a factual finding, I think that's not something that that appellant has proven. And to posit that it's underfunding or that it's usurpation of a prerogative by a court administration, otherwise, when nothing has been shown, nothing has been asked, and nothing has been put forth by appellant when they have the burden, I think that's a step too far.
Your point is well taken about the development of the underlying record for purposes of factual findings. We're reviewing a motion to suppress, so we look at that de novo. And I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. McCarthy, and that is the issuance of a warrant is a judicial process. Only a judge can issue a warrant. Do you agree with that?
Agreed.
And do you also agree that only a judge can recall a warrant?
Agreed.
Okay. Where is the judicial process recalling the warrant? I don't see a judge order anywhere recalling the warrant in this record.
And Your Honor, I don't have that in the record either. And I didn't do any research outside of the record. The only thing that I have in this record that would support that, in fact, it was done is a judicial finding of fact, which Judge Johnson identified how that came about. And apparently this letter, which she relied upon in order to make that assertion. If there was an issue with that fact should have been challenged at the contested hearing. That fact should have been explored at the contested hearing by appellant. It was not done so. It is appellant's duty, not the respondent's duty. Appellant's duty, a burden of production and proof here that they did not fulfill.
All right, and again, your point is well taken. Let me ask you about this document called a Notice of Judicial Determination. This was something that the court administrator put in the file. Have you ever seen that before? I have not.
I have not. No, Your Honor. I've not seen something like that before.
And is there any legal authority for a court administrator to issue a notice of judicial determination? Are you aware of any?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor.
All right. So then if that is the basis, if that document is the basis for recalling the warrant or changing the court record to reflect that the warrant was recalled, is that a legally sufficient, I'm not asking as a matter of fact, I'm asking as a matter of law, is that a legally sufficient process that would effectively recall this warrant? And what would be the authority that would support that?
I would assert to Your Honor that it is not the fact in the title, maybe an unfortunate choice of title. And I'm not sure why it was titled like that, like Your Honor asked. I do not know. I have not seen a document like that. But there are assertions within the document that that I think have value in that judicial determination of Judge Johnson's. And that was a document that was possessed by the parties here and available for exploration and inquiry at the contested hearing, which was not done. So if the judge had assertions from an individual with knowledge under an unfortunately titled document, but which assertions retain their value nonetheless, it is the obligation of the parties at this contested hearing to further explore what is, you know, why is it titled like this? Why was it titled like this, et cetera. So that's where the value comes, Your Honor, is in the factual assertion, not necessarily the unfortunate title of the document. And I've titled things incorrectly before as well. I think we all make mistakes. And I know that court cases have plenty of references to court administration making errors as well. So I wouldn't hold them to a rigid standard there, but rather look for the value in the assertion of that document.
Mr. Wells, can I ask you a bit of a two-part question? The first part is, are you aware of any law that required legal authority that requires an order quashing a warrant be written? And number two, since I assume you practice with some regularity in Rice County, while it might be true, I assume that it's better, of course, to be on the record. So if you got a record of an oral order, is there some common nomenclature or process in Rice County, for instance, or other counties that you might represent individuals in terms of oral orders and specifically oral orders quashing warrants?
On the first part of that question, Your Honor, I am not aware that the order must be written for it to take effect of law. And it could, and I don't know if there is an oral order here. I can only presume by virtue of the finding of fact that there was an order made by Judge Long previously, I guess on December 14th or 15th, and that a record of that exists somewhere. And as to the second one, unfortunately, I come from a family of ne'er-do-wellers in the Rice County area. My father many years ago got in trouble there, and I carried on his tradition in Dodge County. But I am from the area, but I don't practice there regularly, so I can't really answer that second one with any specific.
But in your experience elsewhere, at any experience in that regard, have you seen that before, heard it before?
Of making an oral record and transcribing, I think my general practice is seen wherever I go in the court. If the judge is on the record, there's a court reporter there transcribing and taking down what's said. So if an if an oral record of this exists, it seems to me that we have a date, we have a time, and we have a judge. We should have the capability of locating that. And I would be careful in saying the we, because we is not an obligation here on the respondent. We is an obligation on the appellant to have done that. And rather than making assertions here in court as to why it may or may not exist, it seems that there was a fairly easy avenue to that determination, which was, well, let's pull the transcript of that.
Well, isn't that avenue actually the record? Thing that we do have in the record is all of the communications between the court and the jail for, I think it's like a 3-day period of time that would surround the purported recall of the warrant. And it lists dozens of activities with respect to judicial process on warrants. And Ms. Maleka's warrant recall is not among them. So what do we make of that document?
I don't infer any ill intent because there is an anomaly among the practice of others. I mean, obviously Rice County is a fairly large area. Faribault has, I don't know, what is it, 50,000, 40,000 people there. There's a lot of activity. Court's busy, jail's busy. It's going to be a lot of communication between the two. Sometimes things slip through the cracks. And ultimately we're in a situation now where something has slipped through the cracks. And we're downstream with the consequences of it slipping through the cracks. I don't know that I would impute any otherwise malign intent to the actors here, Your Honor, without some type of evidence to support that. And we don't have any evidence to support that other than there's an assertion that Judge Johnson made a finding that Judge Long issued this order on the 14th. It was entered into whatever it is that county administration maintains it, but then it didn't get passed along to the jail. And so I really, that's about all that I have. I mean, that's all what we're left here with. And if it would behoove the appellant's position, it's really something that ought to be clarified and that ought to have been clarified at the contested hearing. What we have now is a determination that's not clearly erroneous. There's been no evidence to show it's clearly erroneous. So that's a failure of the appellants. Yes, Your Honor.
What do you think? Oh, go ahead, Judge Smith.
Tell me why we shouldn't apply a good faith exception in this case as opposed to the ruling in Lindquist.
Yeah, I have two reasons for that, Your Honor. I think first is the function of this court is one of error correction, and there is here a situation where an arrest was made without probable cause and without per the factual findings, without a valid warrant. If there's no exception to the warrant, then it is a presumptively unreasonable arrest and the search ensuing thereafter is a per se unconstitutional without an exception. That exception does not occur. For this court to apply a good faith exception, this situation would require this court to make a policy determination on a judicial rule that's, and I hate to be the naysayer here, but that is a function that's reserved for the Supreme Court. This court is here to correct the error of the district court. And in this case, the district court said, no warrant, no probable cause, there's no exception. My hands are tied. And this court, to some extent, is in the same
situation. Aren't the facts here distinguishable from other cases where the good faith exception has not been applied?
Are the facts? Could you repeat that question, Your Honor? I'm sorry. Maybe there was.
Aren't these unique facts? I don't recall any case where this issue has been raised.
This is a unique case, Your Honor. One of novel first impression, which is why ultimately my position would go back to the same, that it's something that needs to be decided by the Supreme Court or by the legislature on how the rule is going to apply in that matter. But I would like to point out a second basis, Your Honor, why this court should not adopt the appellant's position. And that goes to the argument of judicial efficacy that was posited or that was propagated by Justice Holmes and Justice Brandeis. And, we have a lot of discussion about the deterrent value or the deterrence factor as a consideration of the exclusionary rule. But there's also the consideration that whether or not the government is to be perceived as a party to improper, or sorry, whether or not the court is to be perceived as an accomplice and a party to the government's improper and illegal gathering of evidence. And those two justices in a number of different cases talked about how very, very important it is to protect the judicial reputation and show its separate function from that of the state police power. Ultimately, disputes between the government and its citizenry are resolved in the hallowed halls of justice. And it is a very dangerous and concerning effect when the courts are perceived to be hand in hand with the parties that unconstitutionally gather evidence for admission at court. And I would ask the court to consider that seriously, because we do have presently, especially, the concerns that all the powers are flowing together and are in cahoots in improper conduct. And I don't believe that to be the case. I know the court and the judicial officers I've always encountered take their obligations very seriously and very very dutifully. And I ask this court to do the same and to consider that that in their determination.
Mr. Welch, can I, in the short time you have, a couple of times you said that because we're only error correcting, we'd be creating new law or policy. If I interpret your brief correctly, is that because the good faith exception has only once been narrowly accepted in Minnesota, and that's in the Lindquist case, and the court was very narrowly, and I assume because as you can see from the dissent, they wouldn't even got the majority perhaps to law enforcement relying on binding precedent. Is that the reason you say that it would be outside our purview as an error correcting court?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And my time's up, and you've said it more eloquently than I can. So
don't give her too much credit.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you, Mr. Welch. Mr. McCarthy, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, before I forget, I've only been here for about a year and a half at Rice County, but I have extensive experience in neighboring and surrounding counties through the Attorney General's office. I've never encountered anybody from Mr. Welch's family, let alone Mr. Welch. He's doing good work, and I appreciate his integrous argument today, acknowledging the strengths and weaknesses of both sides. This is exactly the discussion this panel needs to have this morning. On to the merits. Question came up from Judge Sleater. And there was other questioning on respondents' argument about, well, where in the record is this clearly erroneous? The single biggest thing this court should take away regarding clear error here is the notice of judicial determination did not come into existence. It didn't get created until the day after respondent's arrest. She's arrested on a Sunday. She's in custody. They've already found the drugs based on the valid warrant. The next day, the trial court administrator enters this notice of judicial determination we spend so much time talking about, saying, oh, back in December, this is what happened.
Mr. McCarthy, can I ask you about that? I understood that. In fact, I'm assuming there's a grand oops that was only first realized and never would have been realized but for the arrest. And so but I'm trying to I assume the court administrator is not only an officer of the court but a constitutional officer checked. I mean, I think the judge who in our order reviewed found out who the oops was, and I assume there's an employee who's been reprimanded as a result of it. But in any event, how do we It still says what occurred, and the judge relied on that, I assume, and issued a finding. And what error would be for us to find in those findings and statements?
Two parts to that. It's very interesting, Your Honor. You just admitted three times to things you're assuming. And those are the same things you were questioning me about on the front end. I point that out just because it's kind of, this is a hard set of facts.
Well, I was just responding to the assumption you made, but that's what a court administrator should do and would do. And I would expect the court administrator to do. And it looks like it was done. And so that's my only point of the question.
Yep, no, and I meant no disrespect. I'm pointing out that's exactly the heart of this problem. When we're allowing notices of judicial determination, which have no legal authority anywhere in law, to become a record from which another judge makes findings, that's problematic because Your Honor asked earlier about, what makes an order? Can't a judge say something and that's an order? Well, the problem is you can't appeal an order unless it's a written order signed by a judge and filed in the record, or it's an order, oral order made on the record with a transcript and a court administrator. Same thing Mr. Welch argued. Important key here. I have a way around this.
Can I just ask one other question? Mr. McCarthy, were you the prosecutor below? No, you were not. Before this change to the record was made, do you know if either of the parties were consulted or asked for an opportunity to be heard or anything like that?
They were not. They had no opportunity. This was a stipulated record, and the parties agreed to all of the documents, including there are two printouts, a printout the day before and a day after that show the insertion and the backdating stuff. So the appellant's position is appellant did everything it could to develop the record, except we didn't subpoena a judge because I think that's kind of extreme.
Well,
I'll do it the next time if you need me to.
There is a statement by the prosecutor in the transcript where that accompanied the notice of judicial determination, which I think it said something like, we are surmising that Judge Long probably intended to recall the warrant, but we just don't know. And so what do we make of that, I guess, stipulated statement of the record?
Exactly what it says, Your Honor. We just don't know. Judge Sleater, yourself, myself, counsel, we're all kind of assuming what we think happened, but we just don't know. There's no record. I want to go ahead.
I'm sorry. Does that make the district court's finding that the warrant was recalled clearly erroneous if it's only basing its decision on speculative guess?
Your Honor, that is something this court could determine, say that as a matter of fact, if the document it's basing this on didn't come into existence till the day after the arrest, that's one basis the court could find. The court could remand to have both trial courts, develop it a little bit. Importantly, though, whether a warrant was recalled is not a factual question alone and is not a legal question alone. It is a mixed question of fact and law. The legal aspect of that is the part that this court has lots of latitude with. The factual aspect you have in the record, you also have a basis to find an error.
Right. Your time has expired, Mr. McCarthy. Is there anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Counsel, thank you very much. I know we took you a little bit astray from your briefing. I appreciate your tolerance of our questioning this morning. Well done. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you very much.
Thank you.